Exploring the Human Heart with novelist Thriti Umrugar.
In my way of looking at things, I think every novel should be an exploration of the human heart. I feel like if I'm investing a year of my life in writing a book, I wanted to say something. I wanted to stand for something. I'm not talking about anything as trite as, oh, here's the moral of the story. Not at all. But the exploration of the human heart is almost why fiction exists in some ways.
We talk with Umrugar about her latest work of fiction, The Story Hour. Then we replay our 2012 interview with her about her novel, The World We Found. That's our show today on Writer's Voice. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. In her novels, Indian-born writer Thriti Umrugar plumbs the furrowed depths of the human heart through the lens of cultural collision. Her 2010 novel, The Weight of Heaven, was a story of an American couple who go to India to try to forget the tragic death of their young son. Her 2012 book, The World We Found, explored the clash of cultures between Muslims and Hindus in India, as well as the impact of emigration on identity. Now Umrugar is out with a terrific new novel, The Story Hour. The book locates the boundaries of culture, race, gender, and class, and challenges its characters to transcend those boundaries to arrive at the deepest human concerns, friendship and love, loyalty and betrayal, forgiveness and redemption. The protagonists, Lakshmi, a poor immigrant from India locked into a loveless marriage in America, and Maggie, the African-American psychotherapist Lakshmi is referred to after a suicide attempt. Their hearts are as contradictory as our own. Through the unfolding relationship between these two characters, the reader is prompted to examine his or her own heart and discover the common humanity that unites us all. Thriti Umrugar is the author of 5 novels and a memoir. She's also an award-winning journalist. Thriti Umrugar, welcome back to Writer's Voice. I really loved this novel, The Story Hour, and I'd like to first just ask you just to tell us a little bit about the plot. Obviously, in a novel, you don't want to reveal too much, but give us the setting of the novel and tell us about the two main protagonists. That's Lakshmi, who's an immigrant from India, and Maggie, an African-American psychotherapist.
That's right. When the novel opens, we discover that Lakshmi has just, almost as an impulsive gesture, tried taking her own life. And in other words, it wasn't very well thought out. And Maggie is the psychologist who is assigned to her to treat her. And upon discharge from the hospital, Maggie, who feels this kind of instant connection towards Lakshmi, you know, they have a few things in common in that they've both lost their mothers at a young age. They are both married to Indian men. And Maggie feels this sort of, she's drawn to Lakshmi. She feels this sense of connection to her. And so she offers to treat her out of her home office for free. And in the course of that, and of course, the very concept of therapy is alien to somebody like Lakshmi, who, you know, has only been in the U.S. for about 6 years. She has an eighth grade education. She is the daughter of a farmer. You know, she simply thinks of therapy as the two of them spending an hour a week together building a friendship. And what Maggie's husband quickly helps Maggie understand is that, frankly, what Lakshmi needs at this point in her life is something more than therapy. You know, she needs financial and economic independence. She needs a job. She needs skills. And so as the two women go on, you know, their friendship evolves into something different. And later on in the novel, the friendship is really tested because each woman is harboring a secret that she keeps from the other. And when those secrets are finally revealed, it really tests their bonds. So that's the novel in a nutshell, I suppose.
Yeah, that sums it up very well. Now, this is called The Story Hour, and Lakshmi is the storyteller. She has a wonderful voice in this novel. It's very distinctive. Tell us a little bit about where that voice comes from in Lakshmi, and then by extension, tell us a little bit about her life in India.
Yes. You know, I'll be honest with you, it was a challenge for me to write in Lakshmi's voice. You know, Lakshmi's sections in the book are, as you know, told in the first person, and we really sort of get to hear her, and in fact, there are several occasions in the novel when you almost get the sense that she is directly addressing the reader. And she speaks this, you know, broken, ungrammatical, idiosyncratic kind of English, and I really wrestled with that. It would have been much easier to have written, you know, her in standard English, but that's just how she came to me. She refused to talk to me in standard English, and I just decided to go along with that and to honor the way that she insisted on speaking to me in the course of writing this book, so that when I would come to the Maggie sections, of course, I just heaved a sigh of relief every single time because that was so much easier. But in the course of Lakshmi telling her story, you know, we learn so much about her life in this tiny, unnamed village in India. We discover, for one thing, that she had, quote-unquote, a pet elephant. It was an elephant that sort of just arrives in the village one day, and the head of the village, the landlord, you know, rich guy, decides that he will take on the burdens of sort of raising this baby elephant, and Lakshmi kind of worms his way into this rich guy's heart and becomes the chief custodian for this elephant. We learn about her mom's death and how that really changed the trajectory of Lakshmi's life. She was a very good student up to that point and had to drop out in eighth grade to take care of the home. And I hope we learn a little bit about how, even in contemporary India, rural life is so governed by patriarchy and feudalism, frankly, and the devastating impact that these things have, especially on women.
Yeah, she is very duty bound as
yes.
a woman.
And of course, she doesn't think of it as duty-bound. She just thinks of it as love for family.
Which it also is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's hard to know where one begins and the other ends.
Right. You know, you start the novel with her suicide attempt. She's married to, in what at least begins as a loveless marriage. Tell us a little bit about her marriage and as much as you feel comfortable about why she would want to kill herself.
Well, she's married to this man who owns, you know, who's been in the U.S. much longer than she has. We get to know him a little bit, mostly through Lakshmi's eyes. And we realize that he, too, I mean, even though he has a small restaurant and a grocery store, in the U.S. where he employs his wife also in both businesses, that he himself has known hardship and struggle when he first came to the U.S. But you just get the sense through most of the novel that he just does not love her. And in fact, Lakshmi knows that and tells us that fact repeatedly, that he was in love with someone else. We don't discover who that someone else is until much later in the novel, and basically is not attracted to her and doesn't really love her. So they're both trapped in a pretty loveless kind of marriage. And I'm sorry, what was the second part?
Oh, and the, you know, why she would want to kill herself. I mean, the...
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, as I said earlier, the suicide attempt was really a kind of impulsive gesture. It's just that the only person paying attention to her in her new life in America is this, you know, is this white American guy, Bobby, who was a customer at the restaurant and came for the lunch buffet every Thursday. And he was kind to her. You know, there was never any romantic interest on his part, though we get a hint at the beginning of the novel that Lakshmi sort of was attracted to him. But it's, again, it's hard to know how much of this was, you know, a sexual or physical attraction and how much of it simply was he was the one person who paid some attention to her. He smiled. He said thank you when she brought him his Coke, that kind of thing. And I hope that and then we realize quickly that Bobby is leaving and sort of relocating to California, and she feels completely at a loss. She's bereft. She has no other friend. And I hope that that opening scene sort of conveys to the reader just how bleak and hopeless and lonely her existence is until she meets Maggie. So in some strange way, the suicide attempt is the best thing that happens to Lakshmi because it introduces her to Maggie and then later on to Maggie's husband. And, you know, and for one thing, the two of them, Maggie and Sudhir, her husband, set an example for what it would be like to be in a marriage, a real marriage, you know, where there is attraction, where there is love, where there is passion, where there is respect. None of the things that she has in her own marriage.
And we're talking with Thriti Umrigar about The Story Hour. It's her latest novel, and a wonderful novel at that. These characters really are wonderfully developed. They're full human beings in all their contradictions, and in fact, the contradictions are really what drive this book. Talk a little bit about Maggie's contradiction. She's a psychotherapist, but she comes from a complicated history that has great bearing on what happens in the book.
Yes. So Maggie, as I mentioned, is now, you know, in a good place in her life. She's successful professionally. She's successful in her personal life in that she really loves, I mean, this is her college sweetheart who she has married, Sudhir. There is great respect and love between the two of them. And yet, in a mystery kind of a way, in a way that she herself doesn't quite understand, Maggie is actually having an affair with this guy, Peter, who's a visiting professor at the university where her husband teaches. You know, she tries repeatedly to break this relationship off. She knows what a threat it is to her marriage and finds herself completely unable to do so. And, of course, the paradox or the irony here is that she is a therapist. You know, it is her job to understand human behavior, and yet the workings of her own heart are kind of a mystery to her, which I think is true. I mean, I think that happens very often in life. But some hint as to why Maggie is acting in this reckless manner, you know, risking so much, could come from her own childhood. As I mentioned, her mom has died when she's pretty young, and she has, to put it mildly, a very complicated relationship with her father. Her father, Wallace, is this loving, responsible dad, but during the long years of her mother's illness, there are some hints throughout the novel that something improper went on between the father and this young child. And, you know, Maggie has dealt with it as best she can, but there is some lingering trauma from that, this being starved for affection. And she feels that there is something in Peter that speaks to that, that addresses that wound, and that may begin to explain. And, you know, I'm a great believer I just really believe that the human heart ultimately is a mystery to all, including the person whose heart it is. So it's not like she ever completely understands the connections between, you know, the kind of molestation, if you will, that she has suffered in her childhood, the rejection by her father when that becomes public, and her attraction to Peter, and her willingness to risk, you know, what basically is a very good and healthy marriage for the sake of this.
One of the themes in this, you know, just as her father has crossed boundaries, to what extent we never totally learn, but did cross boundaries. One of the themes of this book is crossing boundaries. Maggie is a therapist, and I was a clinical social worker for 10 years, so I could
wow.
really relate to, you know, kind of the struggles that she has, because she crosses some major professional boundaries in deciding to treat Thriti, for one, as you say, allowing her to come for free, but it goes beyond that. And some of it is because that's, in fact, what her client requires, because her client doesn't understand the traditional psychotherapist-patient relationship. Could you talk about this theme of crossing boundaries and how that figures into the book?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that Maggie prides herself on is that she is unconventional in her treatments. Her guiding philosophy, I think, is, you know, you take your cues from the patient. Whatever the patient needs is how you try and approach them and then hopefully help them. And when I was writing this book and thinking about this whole concept of analysis and therapy, etc., two things struck me. And in some ways, they almost seem like contradictory thoughts, but I don't really think they are. The first was what I've alluded to before, which is simply that, you know, therapy is a Western middle-class concept, and it doesn't always neatly transfer to more marginalized populations. Somebody like Lakshmi, who is really simply struggling to exist, you know, who, as I mentioned earlier, is the daughter of peasants, who has an eighth grade education. The very concept of paying somebody to listen to your problems, you know, also Lakshmi comes from a feudal but also a more community-based culture, right? So if you have a problem, you go to your grandparents, or you go to an aunt or an uncle, or you go to your siblings. You don't hire a professional to help you solve those problems. And frankly, some of those problems like poverty and illiteracy feels so intractable that it feels laughable to think that simply talking about those problems will make them go away. So that's one of the things that I was thinking of in the course of writing this novel, and why Maggie has to meet Lakshmi where she is, you know, which is why when Lakshmi persists on calling these sessions building friendship sessions, Maggie feels compelled to go along with that. But the other thing I was thinking of also is what an amazing concept talk therapy really is, you know, that you basically tell a story, right? You tell the story of your life. You shape a narrative of your life, and then you offer it to this other person who listens. And something in that telling and something in that listening creates something new, and it gives you a chance for transformation. It allows you to shape your own life, to write perhaps a new narrative. And if you distill it down, to me, that's what talk therapy is all about. And hence the title of the book. It's the story hour, you know. It's not the therapy hour. It's the hour that Lakshmi thinks of as somebody here in America, in lonely, cold America, is willing to listen to me tell the story of my childhood, tell the story of how I happened to marry this man who doesn't really care about me. And in doing so, she empowers herself to make changes.
And
Maggie is there with her every step of the way. You know, if Lakshmi says, I'm too embarrassed to sit in a room with you and, you know, look at you while I'm telling you this shameful secret, let's go for a walk instead, Maggie is right there, and they're going for a walk.
And in some ways, fiction, novels, of course, are stories, but this kind of novel is also one that has, I think, a healing purpose as well, you know, because it's an exploration of the human heart, and the reader, as they read it, is making an emotional connection, not just an intellectual one.
Well, in my way of looking at things, I think every novel should be an exploration of the human heart. You know, perhaps some of them do it better than others. As a writer, I'm not a writer who's terribly concerned. I mean, I love beautiful language. I mean, the writers that I admire are fabulous at crafting, you know, beautiful sentences. I love elegance of language, all those things. But I'm not a writer who is only interested in writing for writing's sake or language for language's sake. I'm not that interested in, you know, being clever on the page. I feel like if I'm investing a year of my life in writing a book, I wanted to say something. I wanted to stand for something. I'm not talking about anything as trite as, oh, here's the moral of the story. Not at all. But I think you said it best. The exploration of the human heart, I think, is almost why fiction exists in some ways.
And the other part, that it's actually a healing kind of a journey that the reader goes on. I mean, maybe that's putting it too much, but it certainly fits in this story, because I mean, I certainly found myself engaging with different points of the story where the story has a kind of, even if there's not an illness, precise illness to correct or to heal, that there is a therapeutic aspect to reading a story that it goes into this kind of compassionate depth with characters who are as complicated as all of us are.
Yes, thank you for that. I take that as a compliment.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Thriti Umrugar about her book, The Story Hour. It was published in August by HarperCollins. And could I ask, who are some of the authors that you like especially?
The person that popped in my head when I was talking about elegance of language was Virginia Woolf. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things I adore about Woolf is, to me, she achieves effortlessly, it seems like, the two things that I think are primary for me as a reader. One is just the exquisite, just the beautiful, you know, the pinpoint precision of her language. But the other is, towards what end is that language used? Is it pretty language for the sake of being pretty? Not at all in the case of Virginia Woolf. I think her exploration, her understanding of human psychology is so deep and so wonderful that I just find myself gasping for breath, you know. I think Toni Morrison has that same dual quality of beautiful language, but language that really illuminates the human condition, that really tells you something about how complex the wiring is, you know, in the human brain, the human heart, all of that. And so I could rattle off half a dozen other names, you know, of people who have meant a lot to me and continue to mean a lot to me. But I find myself coming back to these two writers over and over again.
Mm, wonderful. You know, it also struck me that in Lakshmi's voice actually allows for the kind of eloquence of almost a poetic language. I found myself in at different parts, you know, just really struck by the turn of the phrase, almost because she's not a native English speaker. You are able to give her some poetic license that might seem awkward in the tongue of somebody who, you know, like Maggie, who's for whom English is a native language.
I hope to God that's true. You know, I have to confess that I am not objective about this novel yet, only because it was a real challenge for me to write in Lakshmi's voice, perhaps more so than any character in any of my other books, only because her English was just so odd, you know. And one of the questions, for instance, I had to ask myself, and this is just a technical question, but you know, if somebody speaks in a language that they are not that fluent in, and if they are making grammatical errors, would they make the same error every single time? Or would they, you know, would they not? Would they make a different kind of error the next time they even said the same phrase? You know, if somebody's dropping articles, for instance, would they do it consistently or would they at times not do it? And then I also had to indicate that there is some shift and some growth as the novel progresses in Lakshmi's language skills. You know, how do I show that? So I cannot tell you how thankful I am to hear you say that there is a kind of poetic force that comes into Lakshmi's language precisely because it's not standard English.
Well, I think it worked very, very well. The first couple of pages that I was hearing Lakshmi's voice,
right,
it seemed a little awkward, and it kind of reminded me of you know, Huckleberry Finn. and then it just seemed totally right. And so I think you really hit the ball right out of the park with that one.
Thank you. I hope you're not just saying all this to be polite to me.
But, no, not at all.
You know, my biggest fear is that a more impatient reader is going to just fling the book across the room after two pages because they're going to get so frustrated with this weird language, you know. And I hope, like I said, I wrote it in this voice because, you know, for me as a writer, integrity of purpose is just really, really important when I'm doing a book. And it would have been dishonest in some way to have written her in any other way other than the way she came to me.
And the book is The Story Hour. We've been talking with Riti Umrigar. It is just a wonderful book. As I've said before, I urge our listeners to go out and read it. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I so appreciate it.
You can read an excerpt from The Story Hour by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk with Riti Umrigar about her 2012 novel, The World We Found. Stay tuned. Back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour with novelist Riti Umrigar. Like her 2010 novel, The Weight of Heaven, her 2012 novel, The World We Found, is set in her native land, India. It's about four women from Bombay who were the closest of friends as idealistic students in the turbulent 1970s. Over the years, the four have drifted apart. But they're suddenly pulled together again when one of them, who's been living in America, finds out she has terminal cancer. She wants her friends to come together to visit her in America so she can see them one last time.
When we meet them in the course of the novel, they are in their late 40s. But then there are, through a series of flashbacks, we learn a little bit about them in their college days when they were young student activists and radicals in the Bombay of the late 1970s.
The novel opens actually with Lale, who's just received a letter from RMIT, who went to the U.S. after she graduated. She's sick with cancer, and she wants her friends to come and visit her. If you could just give us a little synopsis of each character, maybe starting with Lale.
Lale is somebody who is in a very happy marriage. She lives in Bombay, and she's married to a man who was also part of their little group in college. So they are like school, you know, college sweethearts. And she basically has a very comfortable, very affluent lifestyle, but is forever measuring what she considers to be, I suppose, the vacantness of her life today with the headiness of their time in college. So she's a bit disgruntled between the gap between, you know, the people they were, the world that they had wanted to be part of, and the world that she finds herself in. Kavita is also living in Bombay. She's a successful architect, and she is gay, and she has always secretly harbored this crush on RMIT, which she has never told her about. And so when she has an opportunity to travel to America to meet her, one of the things that she's grappling with is whether to let, you know, past love stay hidden in the shadows, or whether to say something, acknowledge that to the others. RMIT herself is, she has moved to the U.S., you know, soon after graduating from college in Bombay in the 70s, and is now divorced. She has a college-age daughter, Diane, and basically, you know, has a rich and happy life until she gets the diagnosis of the brain tumor. And this arouses in her a great desire to be reunited with the other three. And the final character is Nishtha, or Zoha. She has two names, and I'll explain why. Nishtha is a Hindu woman who married her college sweetheart, who was Muslim, Iqbal, after graduation. And over the course of the novel, one of the things that we learn and one of the things that the plot hinges upon is the fact that Iqbal, more than any of the other five, has really moved away from his radical past and is now a conservative Muslim. And he insists that she take the Muslim name Zoha. And when the others find her after years of absence, they are shocked to discover that, that Nishtha is now living this very constricted kind of life.
Yeah, that's a wonderful roundup of them. You know, through those characters, not just the four main characters, but also the people connected to them, you're exploring a number of different issues which have to do with how things have changed in India, and also how things are still changing. I wonder if we could go back to the time of their youth, that idealistic time. Say a little bit about what was going on there. What was that India, and what is so different about it now?
Well, in a nutshell, what's so different about it now is globalization, you know, which has affected everybody in up to varying degrees, I would say. Several of them feel like the promise of globalization has not been realized, which is paradoxical because most of these characters are, with the notable exception of Iqbal and Nishtha, the other three, or the other two women who are in India, clearly are sort of affluent, and they've done well for themselves and have actually benefited from the winds of change, have benefited from globalization. But since they all still have a social conscience, it's not enough for them to have benefited personally. When they look at sort of the world around them or the country around them, they feel like the 70s were a time of promise, a time when the country seemed poised on some kind of change, and when they sincerely, as young people often do, believed that through hard work they could be part of that change, that they could create a better country. And Lale especially seems particularly jaundiced by the reality that she confronts in present time. She doesn't think, you know, there's a line in the book that says something like, so we've built half a dozen more malls, so what? What does that change? And what she means by that, I think, is how does that really affect the daily reality of people who don't even have the money to enter the mall, let alone buy something there?
Yeah, and that spirit of idealism, their connection, all four of them back when they were in university, got pretty violently torn apart by the Hindu-Muslim violence that came after. For those of our listeners, and I'm sure there are many of them who don't really know much about what happened, could you talk about that?
Yeah, in a nutshell, Bombayites sort of considered themselves to be living in a kind of Oh, certainly not paradise, but what do I want to say? In a city that had largely escaped the kind of religious and communal strife that has so torn apart the rest of the country. They saw it as a kind of safe spot, if you will, until the riots of 1992-93, where Hindus and Muslims simply butchered each other on the streets. And especially for middle-class people who had been protected from that degree of naked violence up to that point. You know, I guess if you're living in the slums, you're much more likely to run into that kind of stuff than if you're living in a high-rise. And there was something about those riots that profoundly changed the way middle-class Bombayites saw their city ever after. And we can trace what happens to Iqbal, who goes from this very secular, very carefree kind of a young man to becoming this rather stern conservative man who believes that there's safety in numbers. We can certainly trace his path to those riots, because not only do they affect him in a global or political sense with the city being on fire, but it also happens to have some very personal ramifications within his own family.
So this is something he really, what happens to him, what happens to his family, is something that he really takes very personally. I mean, it destroys his sense of safety, as you say. And yet the very person that it happens to doesn't have the same take on it that he does.
Yes. And, I mean, it's hard to answer why. Part of it is just the quirks of individual personality, right? We know this in our own lives, that the same horrific events can happen, you know, to several people, and they will all become slightly different people because of it, and they will respond to or react to that incident or events in a different way. So some of it is just that there's a difference between him and the other member of his family. But part of it is also that, you know, all said and done, Iqbal is male, and he is part of a community, he's part of a culture that puts certain responsibilities upon males. And he feels that his job is to be protector and defender of family honor, of the female members of his family. You know, no matter how enlightened, politically speaking, he might be in other ways, there is still this sort of ancient burden that's on his shoulders. And this, in turn, makes him feel like what has happened to this other member of the family, in a sense, has happened to him.
We're talking with Thriti Umrugar about her latest novel, The World We Found. Yeah, it's interesting that in the marriage between Nishta and Iqbal, that it's actually started out as an enlightened act. You know, it was an act here that was a Hindu woman and a Muslim man who come together again, in spite of the religious bigotry of Nishta's family at the very least, if not Iqbal's.
Right, right, absolutely. Yeah, they were the golden couple. You know, they were the promise. You asked me earlier, you know, to talk a little bit about sort of the years when they were in college, and the rest of them looked at Nishta and Iqbal as citizens of a brave new world. I mean, these were the pathblazers, right? This is what they had all aspired to, a country where, you know, old divisions of caste and religion just would play no role. And the irony is, I'm not even convinced that it's necessarily, you know, religion that separates them or breaks them apart as a couple. I think it's much more sort of the ideological changes that Iqbal goes through. Not to mention the fact that they don't have a lot of money, you know, and the kind of pressures that low-grade poverty, if you will, puts on a couple. It's just all those things. It's social custom. It's all those things that act as wedges between them. But mostly it's the fact that Iqbal changes so dramatically.
And is it also because Iqbal's family is Muslim that they're poor?
Well, yes and no, but clearly there are references in the book that talk about the fact that he has faced discrimination in his workplace. He used to work at a bank. And actually, you know, the slight irony here is that as long as his boss at the bank was convinced that he was married to another Muslim. He was treated just fine. But when he finds out that Iqbal is part of an inner religious marriage, that Nishtha was born Hindu, that's when he turns against Iqbal to the point where Iqbal finally hands in his resignation and then, you know, makes a disastrous career choice after that. So, again, it's that fine balance, you know. It's hard to know how much of it is circumstance and how much of it is sort of the role of the individual in making poor circumstances worse.
Yeah, and another thing that struck me was Armaiti. There's a scene where Armaiti is talking with her daughter Diane about Iqbal. That's a very powerful scene. There's a passage on 115. Okay. So set us up here. Tell us what's going on, and then read that section. That would be great.
Okay, so here's a scene where Armaiti has just gotten off the phone, and she's found out that Iqbal is point-blank refusing to let Nishtha travel to America. And she's very frustrated, and she makes some disparaging comment about him being a religious bigot. And her daughter, Diane, to whom she's speaking, kind of questions that kind of what she sees as her mom being extremely judgmental. And you see here not just a generation gap, but also a huge cultural gap between the daughter's understanding of the world and the mother's. So here's the section. So why did she feel like she and her daughter were not speaking the same language? That there was something simplistic, even childlike, about her daughter's understanding of the world? That right now, Diane seemed more like Richard's daughter, good-hearted, well-meaning Richard, whose American innocence had always felt endearing and dangerous to her than her own. That the Diane who was looking at her with a slight frown on her face was truly the child of the American Midwest, sweet but bland, with not a trace of her mother's heritage of spice and vinegar. And you, Armaiti asked herself, what language do you speak? A dead language, the language of a faraway time, of a world that no longer exists, of a time when they had believed the prophet who claimed that religion was the opiate of the masses. They had not seen religion as a polite, innocuous, private issue, as Diane did, or a topic for cocktail party conversations. Not for them the benign New Age, crystals and angels view of religion shared by so many of her American friends. She and the others had seen religion as a ferocious beast to be tamed, as a weapon that the ruling class used to keep the masses in servitude, or a demon genie that the politicians let out of the bottle every time there was an election to be won.
I mean, religion, of course, has become a pretty flaming issue on the horizon these days. I mean, the whole issue of fundamentalism has flared so much. This passage says so much about contemporary issues, but also the way things used to be, and also about deracination. I wonder if you could unpack this a little bit for us.
Well, first of all, to tackle the simplest point, I completely agree with you. I mean, there are, you know, one of the things I always hope, many of my books are set in India. They are set in very specific locales. But my greatest hope and desire as a writer, needless to say, is that they have some kind of universal application, you know. And I never feel that I'm writing, even if I'm writing something about a slum in Bombay, you know, there are slums elsewhere in the world, too. There's the inner city in the United States. One of my books, The Space Between Us, which tells the story really quickly of a domestic servant and her quote-unquote mistress, the woman that she works for. You know, I think that book could easily be set in the American South from 50 years ago, you know, with black and white. So absolutely, I mean, there seems to be a kind of religious fundamentalism that's sweeping across the globe. And you know, people much smarter than me who really study this issue will argue that in some sense it's a backlash to globalization, which, you know, is empowering and making rich many, many people, but is also leaving such destruction in its path that this is something that people have to cling to. And I don't mean to sound like President Obama here, because he certainly got a lot of flack if you recall, during 2008 for talking about people clinging to religion and guns. But I don't think you're insulting somebody by saying that when civic society fails you, as it does in the case of Iqbal, that the thing that people turn to for solace is religion. And sad to say that often it's a very rigid, oppressive, narrow, narrowly defined kind of religion.
We're speaking with Thriti Umrugar about her latest novel, The World We Found. Another change, or you could almost say some of the winners of globalization, are women. And there's this book kind of chronicles a great shift in the position of women in Indian society. One could say maybe with the exception of Nishtha, who goes through her own reverse kind of shift from a greater freedom to lesser freedom. But the others have much greater freedom, one would imagine, than their mothers.
You know, I mean, the fact of the matter is nobody knows for sure. Yes, clearly amongst middle-class women there is slightly more occupational mobility, which hopefully translates into a kind of social mobility that gives them more power within marriages, within the home. But the fact is, until and unless you count every woman who is adversely affected by globalization, you know, who is left behind, so to speak, one doesn't really know. For every Lale and every Kavita, there is also a Nishtha, who you could argue in some ways is a victim, not so much of globalization, but you know, clearly she has taken a few steps back in her life. So yes, on one hand, it has benefited, you know, it has sort of contributed to the rise of the great Indian middle class. But it's also left a lot of people behind.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about yourself. Did you grow up in Bombay or around that area?
I grew up in Bombay, yes.
Which is now known as Mumbai.
Mumbai, I was just going to say. Yeah, I guess I'm dating myself by calling it Bombay. But I just, for me, it's forever Bombay, I guess.
Yeah. Do you feel kind of nostalgia for the old Bombay?
I'll tell you what I feel nostalgia for. And I say this with a hint of self-consciousness, because I realize that I'm describing a very, very narrow slice of life in what I'm about to say. But I believe that the Bombay that I grew up in was really a pretty secular, intellectually rich place. And I guess, you know, given the forces of religious fundamentalism that seem to be blowing everywhere that you look, I miss that. I miss the hopefulness of the late 70s, which was sort of my period, you know. And of course I'm nostalgic for certain aspects of it, but they may not be the aspects that'll make a lot of sense to most people. I mean, what I so admire about that city is the fortitude of its citizens. And I'm mostly talking about sort of the poor people, you know. There is a kind of joyfulness in which they face everyday life under the bleakest, harshest circumstances that you can imagine. And there's a kind of sweetness that veers on a kind of innocence that people there have. And I am filled with admiration every time I visit there. And I just think, how do you do it? I mean, how is it that the city with such grave inequality is not just blowing up every single day? And life really just goes on.
Hmm. Were you there during the Muslim-Hindu riots?
No, and that's something I did want to say. You know, when I started by talking about, the fact that this affected people so very much, I had already left for the U.S. almost a good 10 years prior to that. And yet just, you know, my family was still there, and I would hear the stories that I could scarcely believe on the phone. And it had such a deep visceral impact on me, just listening to the tales, that I can't even imagine what kind of a reaction I would have had if I was actually witnessing what so many people did, which is seeing entire buildings go up in flames. I can't imagine how that would have affected me, because it affected me deeply enough just hearing secondhand the stories of what was going on.
And
it was the end of a dream, you know. It truly felt like the end of an era and the end of innocence in some ways.
Is there any kind of connection between, you know, on the one hand, you talk about, you know, that amazing fortitude and sweetness and, you know, endurance that people have, and then things flame into this kind of violence. Is there a total disconnect, or is that violence something that is just always just beneath the surface, or was it something that was, in fact, you know, exploited or promoted?
Oh, shamelessly exploited and shamelessly manipulated. I mean, much like what we see here with elections, you know. I mean, just preying upon people's worst fears about each other. And in India, you have the compounding reality of the fact that, you know, for all practical purposes, it's still a country and a city, Bombay, with a lot of undereducated or ill-educated or simply non-educated, uneducated people. And so, you know, it's not like somebody can fire up their home computer and go to Google and find the truth about what the politicians are saying. They don't have the means of independent self-discovery. So very often it's rumor and those kinds of things that just prey upon people. And absolutely, a lot of these events are completely manufactured. You know, it is the basest kind of appeal to irrational human behavior.
Yeah. And we are talking with Thriti Umrugar. And let's go back to your wonderful novel, The World We Found. Just as a last thing I wanted to observe about it and have you talk about, it's almost as if we're talking about Armaiti here, who has a brain tumor, and she's asked her friends to come to America, you know, to get together almost for the first time in 30 years. It's almost as if her illness liberates in different ways each of her three friends. Is that true?
That there's I think the ultimate result is one of liberation, but I think the bulk of the novel deals with the process that leads to that degree of liberation. Towards the very end of the novel, Nishtha actually has a line where she says something like she has used Armaiti's illness as a ladder to climb out of the dark pit of her own life. And although hers is the most dramatic example of that, I think the other two, Kavita with harboring the secret of having had this huge crush on Armaiti all these years and never admitting that she's gay to her dearest friends. And Lale, of course, harboring a lot of guilt over what she thinks was her betrayal of Armaiti 30 years ago. It forces all of them to confront things that perhaps they would have chosen not to in any other circumstances.
Well, it is just a wonderful book. I can recommend it to all our listeners. The World We Found. Thank you so much, Thriti Umrugar, for speaking with us here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so very much for having me.
Thriti Umrugar is the author of several novels, including Bombay Time and The Space Between Us, and the memoir First Darling of the Morning. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from The World We Found. We have a little time left, so here's a sneak preview from next week's show. We talk with world-renowned scientist Paul Ehrlich about his new book, Hope on Earth. It's a conversation with ecologist Michael Charles Tobias. You say in the book, Paul Ehrlich, in this conversation, Hope on Earth, your conversation with Michael Charles Tobias, that Earth is reaching a tipping point. Things look pretty dire, but you also say the only thing that's truly practical is idealism. Explain.
Well,
I think
we have to become much more idealistic. If we, for instance, if we want to solve this, what's been called, not by me originally, somebody else, the perfect storm of environmental problems we're facing: climate disruption, toxification of the entire planet, all kinds of problems with the agricultural system. the prospect now still again of nuclear war and big problems with plagues. If we're going to deal with these, first of all, we need everybody working on it, which means that we've got to try and improve the condition, first of all, of minorities and women, and second of all, of the people who are behind the eight ball, either in nations or in our own countries, economically. I mean, we're working now with an economic system that is the Hood Robin system. That is, we're stealing from the poor and giving to the rich. And so unless we can get together and cooperate to solve our problems, we're not going to solve them. So that's one very idealistic thing. And a good example is anybody who can take off their shoes doesn't have to take off their shoes in order to count up to 20 knows there are too many people on the planet and the growth rate is horrendous. How do you solve that? Well, one of the best ways is to give women rights everywhere. I mean full rights, equal to men, full opportunities, and so on. There's no nation in the world where women get the same benefits that men get, and yet we know empirically that when women, the more women's situations are improved, the fewer children they want to have. The second thing we ought to do, of course, is see to it that every sexually active human being has access to modern birth control and backup abortion. If we did those two things, we might start the population slowly declining towards something that might be sustainable. And the other part of the equation, which is, again, idealistic, is that we have to face the fact that the economy can't grow in perpetuity, that consumption can't grow, that the rich already have enough. The whole idea of getting enough, not always trying to have this competitive consumption, is going to be very idealistic, but I'm afraid we're going to have to, both of those things have to be done. We have to control and reduce gradually the size of the population, and we have to deal with overconsumption by the rich while we're trying to improve the status and give more consumption to the people who need it, that maybe 2.5 to 3 billion people on this planet that do not have adequate diets at the moment. In other words, one of the things that we said in the population bomb was that the battle to feed all of humanity is over. That was 1968, and we've been attacked ever since. People said then, don't worry, we can give wonderful lives to even, there were 3.5 billion people then, they said we can give wonderful lives and complete diets to 5 billion people, no problem. Then they said 7 billion people, no problem. Now they say 10 billion people, no problem. And we've always said, you know, why don't you just do it for the people we have today, and then we can talk about how many more we can do it for, because every one of those things has turned out not to be true. There are more people hungry and micronutrient malnourished today than there were alive when I was born. That was about 2 billion people when I was born. And the number hungry today is higher than it was when the population bomb was written. And yet people are totally ignorant of that. And they keep saying, well, what terrible mistake. Ehrlich said the battle to feed all of humanity was over.
And that was Paul Ehrlich in a clip from next week's interview about his book, Hope on Earth, co-authored with Michael Charles Tobias. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.